This morning, I had an opportunity to ask the worship team just a question. I wanted to find out what came to mind first with this question. When you think about those things we waste most, what would be the first thing that would come to your mind? And they, okay, we already have answers. I think I heard even the first answer that somebody said. Dana, the first thing that popped out of his mouth was, Lynn, time, yeah. Lynn wasn't there when Dana said it. That's the amazing thing. Jeremiah said food. And Duncan said relationships. And Peggy said water. And Troy said opportunities. We waste opportunities. Ernie says we waste money. And by the way, he just got back from a cruise, so I wonder why that was on his mind. And I had to look to my daughter for the real deep answer in all of this. She said battery life. The truth is that the most wasted thing in all the world is any life that's not lived for the glory of Jesus Christ. The most wasted thing in life is any life that has not lived for the glory of Jesus Christ. I'd like to put it a different way, maybe more positively. I paraphrase the words of H.A. Ironside. He was one of the great preachers of the 20th century. He said this: nothing in this life is wasted when it is lavished upon Jesus Christ. Nothing in this life is wasted when it's lavished upon the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, you might remember last time as we were looking through the text, we covered a whole chapter in 1 week, which is really an amazing achievement for us. Jesus talked about the fact that the temple that the people so adored, so loved, was going to be destroyed. Now, the reason why that the temple was going to be destroyed ultimately was because he was the new temple. He had replaced the temple. He was a better temple. He was a greater temple. And according to the teaching of the New Testament, we are the stones. God's people are the stones that adorn that temple. And so we all have a part to play in God's program. God's Holy Spirit indwells his people, and therefore we are then by extension called the temple of God. And because of that, there's no need for a temple. But in the first century, this idea would have been radical teaching because all of Israel's religious life revolved around that temple. I think that in many ways, Judas would seize upon what he was saying to betray him a little bit later as we look in the narrative. But one of the things that we talked about as we looked at chapter 13 is we noticed this technique that Mark uses, which scholars call a Markan sandwich. Doesn't sound very sophisticated, but that's a term that they use. And the idea is that throughout the book of Mark, Mark over and over again create structure by taking an idea and what maybe we would call today inclusio. He takes an idea, he starts it at the beginning, and he ends with the same idea so that you know that that is a unit. And so, for instance, when it was time to choose what text should be next, and as you know, we go straight through the Bible, the reason why 1 through 11 was chosen is because this is another Markan sandwich. The Markan sandwich is what structured Jesus' teaching on his return in the previous section, which is what we built our whole case on. And in this section, too, we notice a Markan sandwich. We notice that here at the very beginning, in verses 1 and 2, we notice that Jesus gets a bit of a reprieve. He gets a bit of reprieve. You might know that since the early chapters of Mark, there have been religious leaders and political leaders that have been planning his demise, have been waiting for an opportunity to kill Jesus. But we notice here at the beginning, verses 1 and 2, it was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, by the way, I just want to mention that there's debate based on the use of that phrase, whether or not this was on the Wednesday night prior to the crucifixion or the Tuesday night. I think that it was probably the Tuesday night, but we can't be sure. It says, it was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. So we notice here that, again, the religious leaders wanted to kill Jesus, and in this context, we notice that the ESV translates it that they wanted to do it by stealth. The idea here of stealth, this word could be translated secretly. It has an element of deception. It seems mind-boggling, doesn't it, that religious leaders would be plotting a man's death, and the way that they were planning to do it was by deception. It just reveals to you what their hearts were like. And again, we've said this over and over again as we've gone through the book of Mark. Just because someone wears religious garb, just because someone claims to be a religious teacher, just because someone has a title like reverend or pastor or whatever religious title it is, professor, whatever it is, it doesn't mean just because they have that title or they wear certain clothing that they are God's servants. And we notice this here. They wanted to arrest him by stealth, deceptively, and kill him, for they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people. Now, we notice here in verse 2 something very, very, it seems like it's a positive development. They want to arrest him, they want to kill him, but because of the people, Jerusalem would swell 2 to 3 times its normal size. Jesus had such a big following from Galilee that it's very likely that a lot of Galileans who loved Jesus were there. And the religious leaders, though they wanted to find a way by stealth to kill Jesus, they couldn't figure out how to do that because there were so many people who supported him in Jerusalem. And so they were kind of putting this idea on the shelf. Now, the other part of the Markan sandwich comes here at the end, and I'll just mention this, and we're going to go back to it. But we notice in verses 10 and 11, you'll see the structure of the text. It says, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought the opportunity to betray him. So we notice here how the text begins with a plot to kill Jesus. It ends with a plot to kill Jesus. And that tells you what the structure of the text is. It tells you the section that you're supposed to focus on. And whenever you have one of these Markan sandwiches, the part that we're to focus on the most is the middle section in between. That's just the way you interpret literature. It's the way you interpret the Bible. And so this is a clear picture of one of these things where the structure is laid out for us very nicely in the way that Mark put all of this together. Now, we notice here at the very beginning that in one sense, you read this and you get a sense of relief. I remember one person who got a letter from the IRS. And this letter from the IRS accused this person of committing crimes, of actually submitting false information to the IRS about their business. In fact, it was false information to the IRS that this person was accused of about the way that they were paying their employees. And with this particular person, there was the potential of jail time. Can you imagine? You ever get a letter from the IRS? Get a letter from the IRS and it's maybe a negative letter? Find out you're being audited? One of these kinds of things? And all of a sudden your heart starts to beat and you're nervous. What are they going to do? In this person's case, this person was a pillar of the community, leader in his church. This person had a business, employed many, many people. And there was an understanding that if things went wrong, this person was going to lose their reputation in their church, lose their reputation in the community, business was going to lose its reputation, the family was going to be destitute. Fearful, fearful. And so this person believed that he was innocent. So he fought that with all that he had. And then one day, guess what he got? Another letter from the IRS. And that letter said, "You have done nothing wrong. We're not going to pursue this any further." Can you imagine the relief that he felt when this happened? Person I know very, very well. His family was relieved. His whole life changed in that moment. We get a picture of something like this in this text. We can't imagine how high the stakes were in this situation. Jesus knew that there were people out to kill him. His disciples knew that there were people out to kill him. Yet we get this picture in the text that as much as they had tried to make arguments against Jesus, they had tried to turn Jesus and the people against one another, no matter what they did, and we looked at a whole series of debates that Jesus engaged in with the religious leaders where they were trying to find some way to entrap Jesus. They never could, and so they were going to let it go. And so we get this picture of kind of a reprieve for Jesus. Yeah, we notice here that things began to change. God had a different plan. In fact, we notice a beautiful thing happened in verses 3 through 9. I'll just go ahead and read that again. It says this, "And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment and of pure nard, very costly. And she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, 'Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor.' They scolded her. But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." So we notice that during the week of the crucifixion of Jesus, Jesus would go into the temple, go into Jerusalem each day, and then each night he would go out, and at least to this point, later on we're going to know he slept on the Mount of Olives, but to this point he would go into Bethany and he would stay there at night. Bethany was a town that was only 2 miles from Jerusalem. It was on one of the slopes of the Mount of Olives, and they decided that they were going to have a feast that night. And surely he was the honored guest. We notice at this particular meal there would have been several people there. We notice that that a man named Simon the leper is mentioned. We know from John's account that Martha was there. Martha played a very special part in Jesus' life, and her sister Mary. They had a brother that we know who was there. His name was Lazarus. Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. And so this was a very special banquet that was being thrown, presumably, in Jesus' honor. And in the middle of this particular dinner, a woman burst in. And she had this expensive jar of nard, and she broke it, and she poured it over his head. And if we notice John's account, she poured it over his feet. And we know her name. Her name, again, was Martha's sister Mary. We know that because if you read the account in John chapter 12, you'll notice that. It says it was her. We also know her interests. There's another story of her and her sister. Many of you may be familiar with it, where Jesus was, again, on another occasion, he was kind of a guest of honor. And Martha was running around busying herself, taking care of everything, and her sister Mary was just sitting at the feet of Jesus, just soaking up everything he had to say. Martha was bothered by Mary, and so she said, "Lord, can't you make her help me?" And remember what Jesus said? Mary's chosen the better way. Mary's chosen the better way. At this point, you can imagine Martha isn't even bothering into this scene, into this family where there's Lazarus, her brother, who's been raised from the dead. She loves Jesus. She's heard the teaching of Jesus, and she does this thing. And so we notice her heart. We notice her heart in the middle of this, that she would even burst into a setting like this. Typically, it was strictly forbidden for women to participate in feasts of this nature. But she broke kind of the taboos of the culture at the time because she had to go to Jesus. She was so compelled, her heart was so for Jesus that she could not hold back. Remember once having an experience like this, when we lived in Vancouver, we lived in a community that was mostly Indian. And so very traditionally Indian. I'm told that in our community there was something like 150,000 people from India living in our community. And by God's grace, many people came to know the Lord in that particular church. There were people who came to know the Lord from Hinduism and Sikhism and Islam and Buddhism. And I remember one couple. They were a couple. They had been Hindu, but they came to Jesus Christ as Savior. They turned away from their gods, and God was their God. And so on one occasion, they decided to invite our family over, and they had a small home. They didn't have very much money, but they made us feel as if we were important. But I remember at that particular dinner, it was the husband. They had three sons. The husband and the three sons were there. Faith was seated at the table. And then at that time, we only had boys. We had three boys at that time. And so you have this table, and there was only one woman sitting at the table because Raj and Rajinder, this was the couple's name, Raj and Rajinder, the husband sat at the table, and the wife just served us. And she was in and out, in and out, in and out, and we started to wonder, when is she going to sit down at the table with us? Faith is the only woman at the table. And finally, we looked over and we noticed that she was sitting at another table in the kitchen, and she would grab a couple of bites and then she would come in and serve us. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on us. She's sitting outside because she's not supposed to be here with us. And I'm not sure if it was culturally the right thing or the wrong thing to do. But we asked if it would be okay to have this man's wife sit at the table with us so that we could enjoy table fellowship with her as well. And I remember her coming in, and she looked so uncomfortable. She looked as if she had never sat in a setting like that before. And this is a kind of sense I think that we have in the text before us. It would have been something like that. For this woman and what she did, this would have been so out of the norm. It would have been mind-blowing. She was so compelled by her love for Christ that she came in and she had this jar and she broke it and she began to pour it over Jesus, even though it went against all of the cultural norms of the time. And so she took this nard. The nard, actually, it comes from India. And we notice in the text, as we will see later, that this was worth about 300 denarii, which is about a year's wages. I just went online and I looked, what is the yearly wages today, just to kind of get an idea of maybe how we can make a comparison of the value of this perfume to how it might look in today's world. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median wage for workers in the United States in the first quarter of 2019 was $905 a week. Some of you are maybe really frustrated when you hear that. Maybe some of you are very thankful when you hear that. The median wage for workers in the United States in the first quarter of 2019 was $905 per week, or $47,060 per year for a 40-hour work week. It's a median wage. So she has this bottle of pure nard that's around her neck in an alabaster kind of jar, probably hanging from her neck. And the reason they would have done that is because this would have been their most valuable possession. And then she takes the neck of that bottle. It was probably an heirloom. It could have been in the family for generations. And she's carrying it around, and she breaks the neck. And she doesn't just pour out a few drops on Jesus to save the rest. She takes this and she pours it down upon the Lord. What is your most valuable possession? Would you so readily give it to the Lord like she did? We have this picture of her. When you hear this story, How does it make you feel? In fact, we notice here in verse 4, it says, "There were some who said to themselves indignantly, why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." During the Passover, that was a time where people would give money to the poor. That was part of the deal during Passover. And there was a thought that if they had sold it, they could have really done a lot for the poor. And then it finishes with the words, "and they scolded her." And they scolded her. The word "indignantly" is a strong word. It's the word that was used of Jesus when the little children were kept from him. He was indignant about that. We also notice here this word, it says that they scolded her. That's in the imperfect, which means it's something that it's continual action in the past, which means that when they began, they didn't just say one thing to her. They began to really scold her. When they saw what she was doing, when they saw how she had taken something so valuable and was just pouring it out on Jesus from his head to his feet, she was wiping his feet with her hair. When they saw all of this, their natural reaction from within was to say, "Stop! What are you doing? What a waste! How can you take all of that and just pour it on him? Don't you know we could do so much more with it?" When you hear this story, where do your sympathies lie? Do you feel it was a waste? The story is here to elicit not just to hear about the reaction that was elicited from them, but it's also a story that's placed here to elicit the reaction from our own hearts. How much is too much of our lives to give to Christ? What are the barriers? What's the point in our lives where we will say to God, "To this point and no further"? What are the boundaries that we have set in our own hearts and minds, and we say, "Lord, I will serve you in this way, but if you ask me to do that, no way"? For Mary, there were no boundaries. For Mary, there was nothing in her life that she would not hold back for Christ. Nothing. Nada. Nothing? There was nothing that she was going to hold back. I couldn't think of another N negative word at that moment. And so we have this story where Jesus points out that they can always help the poor. The poor will always be with them, but that in fact she was anointing his body for his burial. I remember in my own experience in my own life, I remember knowing a kid who was very, very bright, very, very gifted, very, very godly. This kid always did what he was supposed to do. This kid was one who shined on every level of his life. This kid was from a Christian home, His parents were very, very wealthy. And this kid went off to college, got involved in some inner city ministry, and decided, instead of going into the family business, that was always the plan, this kid decided that he wanted to go into ministry and wanted to work in inner city ministry the rest of his life. Christian home, godly kid, parents who always seemed to put the Lord first. But as soon as that kid's father heard what his new plan was for his life, his father became angry and resistant and said, "No way is one of my kids going to waste all of the time and effort that I have poured into him working in the inner city." You ever feel like that? You ever feel like when you see someone who's the best and the brightest, and maybe they say, "I want to serve God with what I've got," and you say, "What a waste." Think about Martin Lloyd-Jones. He was a great preacher, probably the greatest preacher of the 20th century. When he was a young man, he was a surgeon. He worked with Lord Hoarder. He was a royal physician in England. He was at the top of the top. He was 26 years old. He had already become renowned for his ability to diagnose different diseases. And then all of a sudden, God grabbed a hold of his heart. And then he felt called to ministry. And so you know what he did? He left his medical practice in London and he went to some little church in Wales. And for the rest of his life, he heard people say to him, "Why would you have left medicine in order to go into ministry? What a waste. Oh, how you could have done so much in ministry." His wife, this is an amazing story. His wife was also a surgeon. So she graduates from school. I believe, I'm pretty sure if my memory serves me correctly, that the same weekend she graduates from school as a doctor. They get married. And then they go off to ministry. And she never practices medicine. Is that a waste? Is that a waste? It's no waste. Because they understood what was more important. They understood that the soul is more important than the body. Yes, the body's important, but we live in a world that's fixated with the body and the maladies of the body. But what Martin Lloyd-Jones understood was that the soul is what ultimately matters, that people are in right relationship with God, and if people are totally healthy but are in wrong relationship with God, they are lost, forever lost. They will spend eternity in hell apart from God unless they hear the good news of the gospel. And so what did this husband and wife do? They poured out the entirety of their lives for Christ. They gave everything that they had for Christ. And yes, there was a time, yes, sir, yes, Martin Lloyd-Jones, he did still practice medicine later on in life. Yes, he did. But what he did with that was he just took everything that he earned in his medical practice and he gave it to the church that he was serving. He continued on in ministry because he understood that what was most important was that people entered into a right relationship with God, and as a result of that, he laid down his life for Christ. And the question that I have for you, and as we read the story of Mary of Bethany, is have you come to that place where you realize that with God there is no place in your life that you withhold those things that are most precious to you from him? Have you come to that place like Mary of Bethany? And so we notice here in this story that a shocking turn of events took place. Verses 10 and 11, then Judas Iscariot, who was who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money and sought an opportunity to betray him. You can imagine Judas in the middle of that situation. Judas probably, when he saw Mary of Bethany bringing that flask in, she broke open the neck of it and she was about to pour it out on Jesus. I'm sure he started to mutter around himself, "Watch, Jesus won't let her do it." And then all of a sudden, when it began to pour, you can imagine in his heart, he was screaming out, "Stop, stop, stop, stop. What are you doing? What a waste." And then after she poured it out and she was wiping his feet with her hair, he had grabbed other disciples. We know from Matthew that it says it was disciples, plural. And he had grabbed other disciples and they began to scold her. "What are you doing? How could you do this?" And the most amazing thing of this story is that these are the people who are closest to Jesus. And these were the ones who objected the most. It wasn't Lazarus who was part of the family. It wasn't Martha who was part of the family. They were the ones who had the most to lose from this. No, it was the disciples who coveted what she had. John tells us that the main impetus for Judas was that he was the keeper of the money bag, and he was keeping back some of the money for himself. And as he saw this nard being poured out, he thought to himself that he was losing something in the transaction. It was driven by selfishness of wanting to hang on to what he thought was his. And so everything turns. At the beginning of the story, we notice that they don't have an opportunity to take Jesus, but then one in his inner circle turns on him. I just want to mention three applications from this text to our lives. Number one, where do our affections lie? Where do our affections lie? Our feelings can fool us. Our feelings can fool us. They can give us, but they can also give us insight into our relationship with Jesus Christ. I've already mentioned this a few times, but I'll just ask it again. When you think about what this woman did, do you think it's a waste? She poured out the most valuable possession that she had, and she poured it out on Jesus. She was like the widow who gave the widow's mite. She poured out, she gave everything she had to the Lord. Do you think it was a waste? If you think it's a waste, it should tell you about where you are in your relationship with the Lord. I remember just one more story about Vancouver. So one time I was at church and heard the knock on the door, and a man came to the door who was friends with another man in our church who was Indian. This man normally wore a turban, but in this case he had a baseball cap on, he had sunglasses, he had an overcoat. He looked like he was in the CIA or something. But I guess he didn't look like he was a CIA. He looked like he was pretending to be in the CIA. And so he was in so much in disguise that he was obvious. He wanted to come in and talk. He had this friend in our church, who was an elder in our church, who was someone who had shared the gospel with him. And he was compelled to follow Jesus, but his wife owned a business. And he was trying to figure out whether it was worth it, because he understood that in his community, if he and his wife became Christians, it would mean that no one would shop at their store anymore. If you were faced with the same decision, what would you do? If it meant your livelihood or Christ, what would you do? If you prefer your livelihood over Christ, you don't know Christ. You see, Mary of Bethany, she preferred Christ over everything else. Second thing, our lives. There is no such thing as a halfway Christian life. You know, it's interesting, in the text we notice that the religious leaders seemed to be deeply religious and pious. Yet there was one obstacle in the way that they wanted to live their life, and that was Jesus. He got in the way of what they really wanted for their life. And sometimes that's how we feel. That we value again our lives over Christ. Which is more important to you, your own life or Christ? There is no halfway Christian life. Mary of Bethany shows us that it's all, it's everything. He's the one who's the giver of life, and he's the one who demands our life. And then the third thing we notice is our example. God is calling us to be examples to others about what it means to live a sold-out Christian life. There was a story about a guy named D.L. Moody. D.L. Moody was an evangelist, 1800s. And one time he met with somebody who said these words. The guy couldn't even remember it later, but it changed D.L. Moody's life. And they were these: the world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully consecrated to him. The world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully consecrated to him. D.L. Moody, who was from Massachusetts, but he was a man who didn't have a lot in terms of his own life, from a poor background, didn't have a lot of education. One time I saw the letters of D.L. Moody, some letters that he had written. He was a poor speller. He had bad grammar. He would not be somebody that you would think would be a great communicator. But during his lifetime, he preached to more people than any other person had preached in the history of the world. No one had surpassed him until Billy Graham. And when he heard that in his heart, he responded. So I'll read it again. The world has yet to see what God can do with a man fully consecrated to him. D.L. Moody, who had very few gifts in terms of what the world might think are gifts. D.L. Moody, who didn't have the right background, he didn't have the right education, he didn't have all of those things. But this is what he said in his heart. He said, by God's help, I will be that man. By God's help, I will be that man. And so he was that example. And the question is will we be that kind of example to others? Who was the example to you in your own life? For me, I can say it was my grandparents. My grandparents were faith missionaries. They were missionaries, spent their whole lives on the mission field, and they never raised financial support, and God always provided for them. Not all missionaries should do it that way. That's the way they did it. That's the way that they lived. They just trusted God, and God always provided. Who are your example? Who's your example of a life like that, of faithfulness like that, of giving of themselves completely over to Christ for his glory and his use? Do you have an example? Most of us don't have an example. How many of us don't have an example? God is calling us to be the example. We're to be the example. Let's not point to somebody else or some other person. Let us be like Mary of Bethany, who give ourselves wholeheartedly over to the Master, where we say, Lord, nothing will be off limits to you. Nothing will we set aside. Nothing will we keep in the corner so that we can keep it for ourselves. Everything, oh God, that we have is for you and your glory. We will be that person. We will be the one who will serve you with all heart and soul and mind and strength. We will be the ones who will cry out, oh God, take my life, take all of me, leave none of me for myself, Lord. I want to be completely and ever and totally for you. I do not want one part of my life, one shred of my life, to be reserved for anything else other than you and your glory. Don't you see the cry of her heart, Mary of Bethany's heart? She did a beautiful thing to Jesus. Don't you want to live that kind of life where you do a beautiful thing to Jesus? Don't you want to see him on that day and he says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Don't you want to hear those words? Let us be a different kind of people. Everything for him. No part of our life set aside. Everything for Jesus Christ. And I will tell you that that same joy that brought her in, where she poured everything out for him, where she went at his feet and she wiped his feet with her hair, that same kind of joy that compelled that in her heart will be the joy that you will experience in his glorious presence. And I'm telling you that nothing that this world has to offer, none of the possessions that we hold back for ourselves, none of the people we hold back for ourselves, none of the things that we hold back for ourselves, none of these things can ever compare with the joy that we experience in Jesus Christ. He deserves every bit of us. Let us be a people like that. Let's pray.